welcome to this week's episode of the Data Protection Made Easy podcast with myself, a bunged up Jasmine Harrison, joined by a bunged up Joe Kirk and Phil.
Hello, who's Hello. Not bunged up?
Hello, how are you doing?
Apart from good,
thanks.
Good, we had good session, good. So I'm on a high.
Yeah, I thought it was good actually. We covered quite a bit of ground. There was a little bit of linkage between the different topics.
Well, loose. You tried, but it was very loose.
Encouraging. Chat was quiet, which either means people have dropped off or they were mulling over what we were saying.
Yeah, let's go. Let's go with that. Definitely.
There were a few laughing emojis in the chat as well, which validates our childishness sometimes.
Yeah, for those that are new, we do try to take these things a little bit less seriously, don't we, and have a little bit of a laugh and a joke. But you know, we also hope that we get some good points across. And do you know what it is? I thought we did, especially around the large-scale processing side of things.
That was great.
Thank you very much, Phil.
That was great. What a great discussion that was. I thought that was brilliant. That was definitely the highlight of the week for me.
Ooh. I'll take that. Star of the week, Joe.
Where's my sticker?
I'll bring it down to the Christmas party. No, it was really good because it was a lot. Yeah. You know, you'd obviously done some research, Joe, the different regulators and where they kind of set the bar and how they tried to put the parameters together for what constitutes large scale. And there's a massive variation and factors we hadn't really considered before. So I thought it was a great discussion.
Yeah, really good research. And we covered a few news pieces as well. Covered 23andMe and then a couple of ransomware attacks, including the one on the US, I suppose, on telecommunication companies.
Yeah, the Deloitte one. Yeah.
Yeah, the Deloitte one as well. Yeah, it was good. It was a really good session, really interesting.
It was quite good. It was about 15 minutes talking again about, and we had some good input from the participants, you know, about the facial recognition and police cameras.
Yeah.
You know, so I think, you know, for me, it was, you know, quite a good session. It covered quite a bit of ground. You know, it was pacey. There was a few links together. But that discussion about large scale, I thought, was the highlight.
Mm-hmm. So stay tuned for that one.
Stay tuned.
Well, yeah, no. So on a serious note, we hope you enjoyed the session.
And you rang me up beforehand and said, I want to definitely talk about this thing. And then I reminded you at the end, I remember now, but that ran out of time.
Oh, yeah. Next time around the National Health Federation, knowing our homes, that will come from the next GDPR radio. But yeah, in the meantime, enjoy the session. Hope to see you on the next one.
Recruiting a few posts and the only job specs doing, which have been done, and then we've had people in for interview this week. Got more adverts out for other posts, so interviewing on next week, so it's really time consuming.
Yeah, I bet. How's your week been, Joe?
All right. I was off quite a lot last week, so the first couple of days I was doing a lot of catch up. I've had a audit report that I had to write up. And then I've just been doing a little bits and bobs. I've been starting to create some documents as well for the consultants to support new consultants when they join us, kind of, you know, what to expect. I'm kind of a bit like a skeleton structure for people to follow, just so we're all kind of on the same page, really. And then just been prepping for this ahead of our Christmas do tonight. So
Christmas do tonight. Woohoo!
Christmas do.
Have you got one? Be a good one?
I've got several.
Why?
Your accent is so strange today, Phil.
Different colours, you know, different styles, different sizes.
I feel like you've got a surprise later.
Have you got a Christmas song?
Christmas do, there was New York, New York.
No, I haven't got a Christmas song. No, I've not had time to write a Christmas song.
What about you, Jasmine? How's your week been?
It's been very busy. I've been trying to get around as many people as possible to let them know that I'm actually leaving DPP at the end of this month.
Ooh, yes, pull them out, please, Phil. I'll have a box for them, please.
I'm going travelling in January across Asia and Australia and wherever I can go. All right, nice one. I'll just get myself off now, shall I?
I'm just bitter. I'm just sad.
Yeah, so I've got, well, I'm not here next week for the podcast, so this is my second to last ever podcast, which is mad. I'll have to get invited back one day. So we're slowly trying to, I think, rope Katharina in. She's going to hate me for mentioning her.
Endorsed.
So big lot of work then to hand things over.
Yeah, so much. I've got, oh, thank you, Maria. I've got a lot of handing over to do. I'm just trying to get around all my customers. I had 9 meetings yesterday, so, you know, there's a lot. There's a lot going on over the next couple of weeks. But, yeah, it's busy time, but exciting times ahead.
Oh. Everyone talking as if you're not going to be back here in a year's time anyway.
Well, keep it fingers crossed.
Happy, Joe.
Yeah, it's a delusional world I'm living in.
So anyway, what's been going on? Anything interesting in the news? Any interesting
apart
cases
from, apart from crying over Jasmine's absence, there's been a little bit in the news. I saw quite an interesting story about the Privacy International wrote to UK MPs following a debate in Parliament that was around police use of facial recognition technology. Right. I don't know if you saw it, but 13 members of Parliament, representative of a range of political parties, as well as the Minister of Fire, Policing and Crime Prevention, all joined the debate. Quite a small amount of people, that is, isn't it? 13 people for something that you'd think would be quite a serious conversation. But apparently throughout the debate, several MPs raised concerns around privacy, surveillance, issues of facial recognition, disproportionately misidentifying people from ethnic minorities and women, leading to further discrimination of communities who already feel they are over-policed. And the Privacy International said that this prompted them to write them a letter to do with the end of privacy in public, which was founded on the results of the YouGov survey, which assessed MPs' knowledge of FRT in their own constituencies and revealed that MPs are asleep at the wheel when it comes to this unsolicited use of facial recognition technology in our local communities. So I've actually got a link to the letter if anyone wants to read it. But I absolutely think it's an issue, isn't it? I think something they've been doing since 2017, I think I read, which is a considerable amount of time, isn't it, really?
2016, I think. I saw an interesting article in the Telegraph, which I'll put in as well, which is about this reporter went and joined the Met Police facial recognition unit, and you know, they're saying within a couple of minutes had already arrested somebody who'd been wanted since 2008. So you know, it being the Telegraph, it's quite in favour of it, so it's quite interesting to read the perspective. Yeah, it's been around quite a while, hasn't it? But it's becoming normalised.
Yeah. I feel like the government haven't really, I mean, I might have just not done enough research, to be fair, but I feel like they've not really done much to control it, really, and to minimise facial recognition technology while it is expanding, you know, across police forces. But I'd be intrigued to see if they actually do anything to, you know, put a bit more of a hold on it, I suppose, because that's the premise I get from the EU. And
yeah, why would the government want to hold it back? Why wouldn't they be thinking it's a good way of, you know, boosting law enforcement?
Because apparently we don't have a government in place that wants to cut red tape or like the previous one anymore. So, you know, maybe they take a different stance, but silence is loud, I suppose.
Well, according to the article that I've put in the chat, Keir Starmer has called for wider deployment of facial recognition technology. But don't forget, he headed up the Crown Prosecution Service, didn't he, in the past? Mm. So he's a former lawyer, so he's probably quite close to
human rights
it
lawyer.
As a concept. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's a bit of a catch-22, isn't it, this with the facial recognition, specifically around the use from police, because, you know, we all want be safer on our streets and for these people to be caught, and if facial recognition does that, then great. But also at the same time, I don't want to be recorded everywhere I go out in public just on the off chance that, you know, they might catch someone that they've been looking for since 2008.
That looks like you.
A lot of people look like you, exactly, so
I'll be there'll be a bias in there that there's all bold people, and they're like, him, bold blue eyes, it's got to be him, and it's just some other geezer that Jasmine ran into last weekend.
It's interesting that, because again, in this Telegraph article, the guy is saying, I'm sitting inside this van, you know, and he's talking through how it works. And they reckon, again, you don't know, do you? It's like a black box thing that, you know, that each person who walks past, their face is captured, is matched against a database of wanted people. And it's scored, a similarity score. Anything above a 0.64 means it's likely to be a suspect. And then they go on to send officers to go and intercept the alleged suspect. But then it says here that the algorithm instantaneously pixelates faces that are not on the watch list, and that data is deleted. So, you know, if that is the case and there's no record of it anywhere, then, you know, it's not such a big, potentially not such a big problem. You know, not like
it just feels like a bit of a slippery slope, doesn't it? In my opinion, well, anyway. Yeah, I feel like it's, you know, this is one step and then it changes and you know, goes further down that road.
And we says it can pick up.
Go on, Phil. No.
Says it can pick up similarities even if a person has a hood up or is wearing a face mask. I mean, how does that work? If I wear a Joe Kirk face mask, is that gonna?
that reminds me of a episode of Top Gear when Jeremy Clarkson was speeding on the motorway and he had a mask of the lorry and he put it over his face, so it looked like he was driving rather than him. So he got the points. Sorry, Phil, just to...
No, that's just... I just wondering, you know, it sounds quite capable technology, doesn't it?
I got a new phone this week and it's got Face ID on it, and you can also choose to use Face ID with a mask as well. Obviously, you've got to, you know, put that into your phone yourself, but...
What, a ski mask or something?
Like one of those...
It's special for bank robbers.
Yeah.
The bank robber edition of an iPhone. Yeah. You can unlock your screen even with your ski mask on.
But yeah, I do know, I've heard in China already, because I mean, I think it's probably a lot more normal to wear masks there just due to the...
Oh, one of those, right, okay, yeah.
You're one today, you. You know, to just wear masks because of the...
Pollution.
Pollution, I was going to say population. Thank you, pollution. So I think they're quite well fared with that sort of technology to identify people whilst wearing masks. So I suppose, you know, it's just a step closer to that sort of technology, I suppose.
Yeah, and I know that being recorded in public, you know, has been a thing for as far as I can ever remember. I don't know when CCTV kind of was introduced, but, you know, Phil, you've got a bet not to... make you feel like you're a little bit older than us, but was it
you always say this?
Well, he was around for the internet, so was he around for the introduction of CCTV
introduction of cameras back in 1874 or Fox Talbot and all that?
But the point I was trying to make is, though, it's becoming more prominent in terms of us being aware of it now, because do you remember I said earlier in the year, didn't I, when I went to get some Euros, that John Lewis had facial recognition at the top of every escalator in Leeds? Yeah. But I don't know if any of you, if you two have, or anyone listening, have been in Leeds train station recently, but now you walk to go to the barriers and they've got a massive 60-inch TV that shows a recording of people just like coming in and out, and it's one going one way and one the other, and you can just see yourself, and it's like, why? And I know it's probably for ticket touts, but can you not just have a CCTV camera that is positioned on the barriers itself, as opposed to like looking out onto the, like, I don't know if you've been Leeds station, but there's like quite a big area, isn't there, that you walk onto once you go through the barriers. It's like quite a big bit of concrete before you decide where you go.
I hope it's not to check age verification for rail cards.
I read somewhere that there's 243 cameras in Leeds City Station.
Really?
Really?
Oh my God.
Is that, David is had that his like hand a... up, but it's gone down
again.
Oh, yeah,
sorry, David.
It's all right. I was just going to make a point. I think you were talking about two slightly different things, because even if you look at the European legislation that outlaws certain of the use cases, actually, you're almost mixing... doesn't stop you being recorded. The AI legislation in Europe doesn't stop being recorded. In fact, it doesn't stop the AI being used against the recordings. What it stops is that real-time monitoring that you're talking about. And I'm sort of almost of the opinion that if you're going to sit there and be videoing anyway, you might as well do something useful with it, assuming it's in the right circumstances. And I think the other bit I was going to say that, I mean, Jasmine and Joe are both going to be lucky enough to not have to go through, and Phil probably did, I'm guessing, and I definitely did. It's, you know, part of the reason that London has got a lot of cameras is we have a history of sectarian terrorism, unfortunately, very unfortunately, in our country. And that's why London's covered in, well, and most of our major cities. That's when we started to see a lot more CCTV recordings, was around a, at the time, very real terrorist threat. So that's why London, or not the only reason, but one of the reasons, and it's why you started to see a proliferation of CCTV in public spaces, because of that, you know, very real challenge that is potentially here today, but in a different, well, hopefully in a different guise.
I definitely remember in the early to mid-90s, the proliferation of the city centre CCTV schemes. I don't remember them. I was a student in London in the mid-80s. I don't remember, late 80s. And I don't remember noticing CCTV then. But then I was a hotel and catering management student, so I probably wouldn't have paid any attention to it.
Any job you've not done.
So I don't even remember, but I think you're right. You know, there is that history. And technology has got to be have been used to try and combat those threats.
It's a hard one, isn't it? Because there are, you know, real reasons for needing and wanting the technology, but then it does, on a personal level, go against.
It does. You know, but, you know, what about the awful case in America, in New York City, earlier in the week, where the chief exec of the insurance company was shot? You know, somebody walked up behind him and shot him. And they've got CCTV footage of the perpetrator. But I don't know whether there's any opportunity to try and identify somebody from that. But that would, you know, there's a really hard decision to make. You know, we want to be safe on our streets. We want people who commit serious crimes like that to get caught, or chance of them getting caught. And the technology's got to be there on the off chance that somebody walks across the street and shoots you in the back. Or does it? You know, if it's not there, there's very little chance of, or less chance probably, of catching the perpetrator. And you can't have it both ways.
I think if the concern or fear or whatever you want to call it probably comes down to potential misuse. So, you know, is it a slippery slope? Will it then be used to monitor individuals on, you know, more extreme level? Or is it just used for that crime prevention and detection? Which I think at the moment it is, but you know, how will things go in the future? Is will it even be monetized to some extent, the way targeted ads are, the way you tracked on your phone, for example? Obviously it's a bit ridiculous for that to be the case.
The other worry is how secure is it? So we've talked on this podcast before about, you know, overseas malicious actors hacking into CCTV networks, you know, and it's quite possible that sensitive areas are also being monitored not only by our own security forces but overseas security forces. I won't put it past the realms of possibility.
Did you, I don't know if you read that case, you sent me a link to it earlier about the hack in China. Sorry, not in China,
Deloitte.
In America.
Don't
no,
the telecoms one.
Yeah, so yeah, there were over or at least 8 telecommunication companies, including AT&T and Lumen Technologies, that were hacked, and essentially the blaming it on China, saying that Beijing officials have access to private texts and calls of a large number of Americans. They've stated that it's not all Americans that have been affected by this breach, but a large number of targeted individuals, including potentially Trump and Kamala Harris as well. So, yeah, it's quite interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because everything's blamed on China these days. But
I know.
But the Chinese officials have said it's nothing to do with us, but you ought to stop hacking our systems as well. So, I mean, it's there, isn't it? It's a two-way, two-way thing.
Two drones spotted above England Air Force bases, but that were supposedly from China as well, that Americans were using over here. Always, I'm sure I've read that or I dreamt.
There were some drones spotted over military base airfields this week or last week.
I think that was blamed on China as well.
Yeah. As were those big hot air balloons. Remember those big meteorological balloons?
I do. Yeah, in America. Yeah, yeah.
I don't know about that one.
It just seems like the easy. You can either blame it on Russia or blame it on China. One, you know, flip a coin, which one?
Yeah. Now, I don't know if you saw that Deloitte's have been hit by a ransomware attack as well. That was quite interesting because there's been like a terabyte's worth of data that's been apparently stolen or locked up. But the hackers have said, unfortunately, giant companies do not always do their job well, which is, you know, they're saying that there's some quite elementary things that were wrong, you know, and they've managed to get their way in and then, you know, lock down some data. And I think that's that's probably a fair comment, isn't it? We often go into organizations to do, like, for instance, a GDPR, a security audit, and we expect it to be top notch, and quite surprised when it's not.
Yeah. I mean, you see that. I see that with customers all the time. Well, not all the time, but over my time, where, you know, they'll look towards a similar organization's privacy policy and copy that because there is that expectation that others have it right when it's just not really the case, to be fair.
Yeah, we experienced that, didn't we, Phil? Ourselves, was it 2 weeks ago? We went on site and did an audit, and was it the retention policy, wasn't it?
I believe it was retention policy. Yeah.
And they got it from another council. And, you know, they were just under the assumption that must be right. And it wasn't. And we just sat.
XYZ Council will retain data for this long. All right. Okay, that's good.
They will do
then?
It. Yeah.
Yeah. But all these things are linked together, aren't they? If you've got CCTV and you've got these big, you know, big organizations that are managing the footage and managing installations, you know, and they're, you know, the hackers are saying, well, they haven't got it right. Well, you know, what is right, you know, it's a moving target as well, so it's not easy to get right, and you might only have it right for a momentary period in time, and then all of a sudden, you know, it's falling away. But they're linked together, aren't they? And the more data you collect, the more sensitive it is, the more decisions are getting made about people, the more relying on, you know, technology and technology suppliers, you know, then they're potentially more susceptible to attack.
Yeah. Speaking of large organizations, so do you remember probably up to 2 months ago when LinkedIn were offered ordered a $258 million fine for non-compliances with mainly the fairness, lawfulness and transparency principle? Well, I was talking with Rashmi, I don't know if she's on here, but I got a follow request offer on LinkedIn the other day, and I was quite surprised. I thought, I swear I've already got her. It turns out that her old account had been compromised because she tried to verify her account. You know, I don't know if anyone's tried to do that or has done that, but basically it takes you to another site and you've got to show your ID, like your passport or something, to verify your account. I went to do it a few weeks ago and then saw that you had to do that and just didn't. But that led to Rashmi's account being hacked, essentially, and information being changed on it. So she changed the password and then created a new LinkedIn, tried to report it to LinkedIn, and their response was just ridiculous. Like, they just didn't take ownership of it, and then it was unclear whose breach it was, whether it was, I forget what they're called, the third party, actually, but I'll have a quick look. But yeah, whether it was LinkedIn or the third party. And she shared with me the message log, you know, the chat log of the complaint, tried to put in a subject access request,
Persona,
that's it, thank you. Turns out they deleted all of the data instead as part of an erasure request that was just an absolute, you know, show.
erasure request from her, or erasure request from the person who had hijacked her account?
Well, from, no, so there was, well, I don't know, there was no intended erasure request. She meant to put a subject access request in, and then there was no, they couldn't find any details relating to the account, and it was all just a mess. And LinkedIn's response was, it could be down to these reasons why the breach occurred without any actual investigation into it. So it just, you know, provides absolutely no assurance that they've got this under control. You know, or they've probably dealt with these things before, and it, you know, there isn't an internal process into this breach. I think there's probably two breaches, you know, the initial unauthorized access, and then obviously the deletion of her data, and just nothing really done about it except an apology. So just something to be wary of.
I worry about, you know, all these different platforms saying, oh, upload a copy of your passport, you know, or your driving license, official government documentation, because I honestly can't trust them with it.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to sell something on eBay, and my account, they won't let me until I've put a copy of my driving license or passport in, but I'm very reluctant to, because I just don't trust them to not lose it.
Yeah, I had to do it the other day. When I was buying my secondhand phone, was it Back Market? I bought a phone off, and I had to
Black
put a picture
or...
back market.
Oh, right, sure.
I think so.
Around the back of the market. Did you say it was around the back of the market in Leeds?
Where did the phone come?
Be probably cheaper if I did it that way.
Where's the the phone come from? Is it spying on us?
Yeah. It's my old one has been stolen. So
but anyway, so I had to put, but to buy the phone, I had to put a picture of my passport in and then a picture of my face as well. And it made me feel a bit uncomfortable with the fact that I had to do that. And it made me think as well of this, you know, online digital ID that the government's proposing. And I don't actually think it would be that bad an idea if it's something that, you know, isn't stored by these organizations. It's something that you can use to verify, and then, you know, they can't store it, they can't access it, it's just that tick box and that's all they need. You know, like for example, when an organization collects DBS related information, criminal conviction data, and then they delete it and just have the tick that, you know, it was actually undertaken, the check was undertaken, that kind of thing, then I back it really, because it does make me feel uncomfortable, the fact that you've got to put this information in various places for various reasons, you know.
Now, on a kind of related note, only related in the fact that LinkedIn is a US company, I don't know if you saw that the European Data Protection Board have reviewed the data protection framework and approved it for a further 3 years, up to 3 years.
Really?
Did you see that? Yeah.
All right,
in the news. Well, it's quite interesting because they've written a paper on it and they're saying, you know, these things we're really pleased with, you know, like the congressional order, whatever it was called. But other things are saying, you know, we'd like to see some improvements here and here and here. So again, if anybody's interested, I'll put a link in to here to the report and the press release. But yeah, interesting. So, you know, LinkedIn, you know, maybe not satisfying, you know, the rights of the data subject fully, but self-assessing and find no problem, crack on.
No, it's concerning. The whole approach to it is really concerning, especially because they were fined over a month or 2 months ago. Hopefully, you know, they're in the process of improving their internal procedures and I don't know, just data protection compliance in general, really. But yeah, we'll see. Time will tell. For the time being, don't be verifying your accounts.
Well, yeah. I mean, Joe, as I said the other week, didn't we? Joe and I went to stay at a hotel in Chatham, was it? Rochester?
Yes.
And they wanted a copy of our driving licenses, and we took a photocopy of it, and we asked why, and they said it's because in case you create any damage in the room. But, you know, I'm not sure how it helps them, but it's just, you know, the more and more.
Surely
and more
you just
and more
get a deposit on the card you paid with.
Well, yeah, I mean, more and more people are saying, oh, no, let's have a copy of your government ID. It's like a trendy thing. Yeah. It seems like it's a trendy thing to do now, but it's just completely wrong.
And the thing is with that is that people who aren't really particularly aware of kind of, you know, the implications of handing over such information don't really see the concerns that we do, you know, because we're in and amongst it. You know, we know that it's not reasonable for you to collect our driving license and the off chance that I destroy the room. You know, there's probably better ways. Like Jasmine says, a bank card would make more sense, right, than a driving license. Like, what are you going to do, report me to the DVLA that I've trashed a room? But people won't think twice about that, though, will they? They'll just be like, oh yeah, there you go, you want it. Like, they'll feel like they have to do it, otherwise they're not going to let in the room. And I just think,
well, like here, what Chris is saying, that you couldn't book a room into a hotel in Birmingham without a passport,
which is just nuts, right? What do you need a passport for, to put you in a hotel?
I mean, overseas visitors might, for, you know, local policing laws and, you know, things like that. If you go overseas, sometimes you have to register your passport
at
the hotel, don't you? But I don't think you do in the UK. I might be speaking.
I've never had to put a passport when booking a hotel. I guess maybe abroad. It depends on the... No, here.
Oh, right.
I guess maybe it depends on the hotel. You know, if it was near the airport, maybe you could justify it a little bit more. Is that they'd expect people to be coming in and staying. You know, as Phil said, if you come in from abroad and you have to leave your passport, as you do when we go abroad, then, you know, maybe that could be fair enough. But yeah, it just doesn't feel right, does it?
So this European ETIAS scheme is coming into effect, isn't it, next year? This is where we've got to fill in more forms and I think biometric data to be able to travel into the EU from some point in the relatively near future. Again, that's again a proliferation, a lot of data being collected. Proliferation of data, yeah.
Got there
in the end.
Didn't help you, but
I'm not that clued up actually on what's going to be required of us to start traveling to different parts of the world. I guess it's Brexit was a little bit before my time. I wasn't quite old enough to vote in it. And I imagine it is a...
Who are you trying to kid?
Whoa, I was 16. It was 2016, wasn't it? Brexit.
Oh, you're an August baby, aren't you? Yeah.
I am. And although I might not look it, I am only 25.
No comment.
Well, have a look at Etias, but it was a lot easier to before that in many respects. Now, I don't know if you saw, you probably did, because I think you said you spoke about it a few weeks ago, the European Data Protection Board's opinion on key insights on using processes and sub-processes. Again, I think fascinating reading, really good. Did you talk about it a few weeks ago?
I think we did, yeah. But you can refresh our memories.
the key kind of takeaways are, you know, the data controller is fully responsible for identifying all processes and all sub-processes. You know, when it comes down to it, it's that you've got to do it. And processes should proactively inform controllers of any sub-processes. You know, controllers remain accountable for the entire processing chain, according to the European Data Protection Board. And again, this is only in relevance to reference to the everything we're talking about, which is often, you know, processes processing data for storage or for, you know, like there will be in the Etias scheme. It's not the governments that I wouldn't have thought they're going to store the data. It should be some third party processes appointed. So you got to, you know, got to go to grounds. I mean, there's quite a lot of key takeaways, in that opinion. But it was quite interesting to read. I'll put a link into it just so people can see it. Oh, this just popped up on my screen. Something's very strange. I'll put a link into it.
So well, am I right in thinking that you said the controller is responsible for the whole chain?
That's right. So, yeah, including international transfers.
That.
It says that it's not a one-off. The responsibility is ongoing. Controllers must regularly verify the guarantees to ensure continuous compliance. So it's a lot more. I mean, I know we kind of say that, we preach that. You know, when we write in the standard operating procedures for our customers, we're building that into them, saying you have to keep a watching brief on these things. But I don't know how many organisations do that. You know, regularly review their processes.
I get it from controller, processor, sub-processor, because it is, you know, it's within Article 28, I believe, that the processor needs to inform the controller of any sub-processors. But then those sub-processors, and, you know, it goes on that down the chain. I think that is... It's a lot for an organisation to control and manage.
The guidance is saying that the controller is responsible for the whole chain, as opposed to that just seems so unworkable in practice, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Well, given that a processor has got to present a subprocessor for approval, not sure. So, you know, imagine that approval process. You know, we want to change from using XYZ to ABC. You know, you've got 10 days to turn us down, which is factually how a contract could be construed. Then you'd be saying, okay, fine. You know, show us that you've done what you've done on them. Show us the contract you got with them, you know, show us anything else. It does say in this guidance that you take a risk-based approach, you know, for things that are less impactful, you can do less due diligence, etc. But yeah, that's basically what they're saying. Yeah, you're fully responsible for the whole chain.
Some organizations will use a considerable amount of sub-processors, won't they, to you know, do various different things for process activities. So that could just be, just think it's quite a lot of work.
It's a big, big thing. Big, especially, and then, you know, cloud systems .
It's so difficult as well, because the amount of breaches that we talk about from third parties, you know, it is important, and that is enough, you know, to have to get your ducks in a row with this, like, as a holistic project. But
yeah, but doing all that
in practice
I'm thinking about
the NHS, for example. You know, they'll, where there's so much data, you know, that if it is breached, you know, it can have massive repercussions. And
but then trying to manage that on top of all your other practices of, you know, updating your ROPAs and your privacy policies and giving training, and
For small to medium sized businesses or organizations, you know, or even those public sector charities where they're under, you know, budget pressure, well, we're under budget pressures these days, I suppose, it's a big ask, isn't it? If you've got a big information governance team, you know, they may be distributed across the world, maybe it might be a little bit easier, but probably not, because everything's scaled up, isn't it? Probably more processes. But yeah, ultimately, the controller retains ultimate accountability for the decision on whether to engage a specific sub-processor, is what this guidance says.
Well, then.
So I know you spoke about it a few weeks ago, but I thought it was just really, you know, interesting. I do like what the European Data Protection Board produce, and I think it's easy to read in the main. But it is the European Data Protection Board and not the ICO. So, you know, but usually they've got well thought through, you know, rationale behind, you know, what they say.
Yeah. Now, we've spoke quite a lot about news stories. I've got something that I want to kind of discuss that's a very niche area of the law, I guess. It's around large scale processing. And it comes from I was earwigging a little bit, I guess, on Monday. Dilik, who's one of our senior consultants, went and took some of the newer support desk team members down to do training on DPIAs. And they're only meant to be down there for a couple of hours. And I think they ended up coming back up after about three. And they said that they were just sat having a debate about what is large scale processing.
Oh, good on them.
It's something that I've kind of not. I think I've got a pretty good understanding of what large scale means, but I think there's some people, especially people who are new in the world of data protection, that, you know, might struggle to kind of get to grips of what that might mean. So I went and did some digging to see if I could find some guidance. And I just kind of wanted to talk through different variations from, you know, different sources. So what I found was that Working Party 29 recommends that following factors in particular should be considered when determining whether processing is carried out on a large scale. And that was that the number of data subjects concerned, either as a specific number or as a proportion of the relevant population, the volume of data and or the range of different data items being processed, the duration of permanence of the processing activity, and the geographical extent of the processing activity. Recital 91 says that large-scale processing operations which aim to process a considerable amount of personal data at regional, national, or supranational level, and which could affect a large number of data subjects and which are likely to result in a high risk, for example, on the account of their sensitivity, were in accordance with their achieved state of technological knowledge and new technology is used on a large scale, as well as other processing operations, which result in a high risk to the rights and freedoms of data subjects. In particular, those operations render it more difficult for data subjects to exercise their rights. Estonia's data protection commissioner posted on LinkedIn explaining his officer's position on large-scale processing, saying that where it's special category and or criminal conviction offences data, at least 5,000 people, data causing high risk of at least 10,000 people, so things like payment services like online banking and credit card data, was 10,000, and then any other data of at least 50,000 people. The Netherlands Data Protection Authority said that data processed by hospitals, pharmacies, general practices, centres and care groups are always considered to be large scale. For smaller general practices or pharmacists working solo as well as specialist medical care centres, data processing is large scale if more than 10,000 patients are registered within the practice or more than 10,000 patients are treated on general basis and all patient files are maintained on a single filing system. There's really quite some nuances in some of the guidance out there, but they're all quite similar. If you don't mind, I'll carry on.
I think it's great.
I'm just conscious I'm talking a lot. So the Czech Republic, their DPA. Well, no, come on, us and quizzes, we mix like oil and water. The Czech DPA provided a threshold, which in this case was 10,000 data subjects. Processing by more than 20 processing branches or by more than 20 employees is considered to be large scale. Organizations will need to take into account if data processing is at a regional level or at an international level, the latter being more likely to be large scale. Now, in Germany, the Federal Data Protection Commissioner has issued an overview of data processing operations that are subject to a DPIA, defining that large scale processing as data processing operations which cover more than 5 million people or those covering at least 40% of the relevant population. The latter threshold is thus dependent on the type of data that is being processed as well as the data subjects involved in the operation of the processing operation. Now, just to summarize three of those, so the difference in the Estonia and Czech Republic. So Estonia's threshold was 50,000 people, which is under 4% of the country's population. Germany was 5 million people, which is under 4% of the country's population. And the Czech Republic threshold was 10,000, that doesn't seem right actually, but Czech Republic threshold was 10,000, which is under 0.01% of the country's population. So 4% of the country's population, 4%, and then 0.01. So really is quite a, you know, similar, but slightly different.
Yeah, but what's really interesting, I think, out that is the Czech Republic saying if you've got more than 20 employees, so they're kind of this notion of scale is this extent of the processing activity rather than or in conjunction with or as opposed yeah. to the number of data subjects or the complexity of the data or something.
Yeah, and then Poland just issued examples of what may be deemed large scale, and that was processing of medical records, employee documentation again, systems in which a processor processes data from multiple data controllers, and then databases collecting a wide range of data about web pages, browsed, completed purchases, and or TV or radio programs watched or listened to.
10,000's a low bar, isn't it? A low threshold.
Yeah. And then the ITO, again, just had examples, and theirs was data processed by a hospital, tracking individuals using a city's public transport system, processing of customer data by banks, insurance companies, and phone and internet service providers. And I think the kind of why I wanted to raise this is that the law is quite grey in areas, and it can be quite tricky, can't it, to kind of wrap your head right, what does this actually mean? And I think large-scale processing, although us three sat here, we've been doing it for quite a while, we'd probably have quite a good gauge of what large scale might mean. But I was just conscious that there might be some listeners that haven't really quite considered that. But I think context is key, is what I've probably got from this.
I think the idea of large scale is so subjective, though, because to me, my automatic reaction is this, is that I don't like the fact that the naming it of this many people is considered large scale or processing of so many people, because what if you get one less than that, it's, and then what if it's something is more, sensitive, or it's got more knock-on effects than some other type of data, but the group is slightly smaller. I think like you said, Joe, context is key. It needs to be considered in relation to each specific activity, but I think it's more than that as well. Like, this has put things into a very different perspective for me, in the sense that all of these, you can say they are large scale, where it talks about hundreds of thousands, tens of thousands of people and whatnot, but or like processing of a hospital or city's public transport system, they're large scale to me.
Well, they're not. But what is a city? The population of Wells in Somerset, which I believe is a city, is 12,000 people.
That's fair enough.
The population of Ely is 19,000 people. The population of Bangor in Wales is 15,000 people. And about 6,000 or 7,000 of those are students. So the native population is significantly less. The city but and city, Greater London,
with that, though, I think
Birmingham,
that,
different.
That backs my initial understanding of, it depends on, say, the organization, for example, the size of the organization for one, and say how many records of personal data they process, full stop, and how many of those are special category. There are obviously levels of, if they were to process four records and two of them were special category, then it's obviously not large scale, so it complicates things again.
I said the generic descriptions, the Friarich Hospital in Northallerton is a different kettle of fish to the Leeds General Infirmary, I would have thought, massive hospital, mega hospital in London.
Yeah.
Or a private hospital,
A lot of those guidance, though, they did say that was probably the thing that cropped up the most, was that medical information is probably considered large scale, but they just said all medical was. So as you're saying there, Phil, is that data of 5,000 at one GP is considered large scale as much as a hospital that sees, a million people over a course of a year. And I guess that links back to what you're saying about the city thing and the transportation. But context is key, I think. And the sector that you work in as well, probably will determine what's large scale. So I think I try to use football as an example. Could you determine a threshold of what's large scale in processing in terms of fans that attend a game? Would you maybe say anything more than 5,000 fans that attend a game is considered large scale, and anything below that, probably wouldn't be. I guess it's
you show me a stadium in a professional football, cricket or rugby club that houses less than 5,000 people. I mean, I know that.
Well, at League Two and below, probably.
The structure, but
that's all.
I think
I
you could
there,
instead of going on specific figures like you've given examples of, Joe, if you went off percentage of records processed by the organisation, I think that would make things a lot clearer. Obviously, there's different scales to that and what 1% would be of a hospital compared to us, for example, it's very different, but I think that would help. I think it would help.
I'm not sure.
I don't know.
So let's talk scale it up then to Facebook. Facebook has got, what, 300 million?
No, a billion, I think. Billion users. A billion.
So what's the percentage of that of the global population? It must be, well, about 7 billion, is it? Global population?
Yeah.
So a seventh. Take. That's significantly significantly not 4%, is it? So if you're saying 4% is a threshold, I suppose what we're saying then is that Facebook is doing large-scale posting because it's got, you know, 15%, is it, roughly, of the global population it's processing?
I don't know.
Broadly, my mental math is never very my strong point. Anyway, all interesting stuff they're looking at the concept of large-scale. So what did the conclusion that the team came to, Joe, that it was like everything, it just depends?
Oh, no, I didn't ask. They it was the end of the day, and then I think they continued it the next day. I probably should have asked what was their thing, but I think they all had different in opinions.
Well, and that's right, because there's no right answer, is there? There's obviously wrong answers, but it's about applying the law to your own certain circumstances and then justifying your position. But you have to do all this background reading to help put into context your own scenario.
Yeah, and I think it's just making the point as if you are going to say that it is that, you need to make sure that you're justifying why you believe it is large scale or it's not large scale.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's, I suppose it's one of those, you need to look at both sides of the argument and see which weighs up better. To be honest, I think I base it a lot of the time off gut feeling as well, based on the size of the organisation, how many records they process. In it sort of partly in relation to like the actual number of records, but also in relation to the size of the organisation and the typical process and activities they undertake. I think that's the premise that I would typically take, but...
But we're
it's
still
not
thinking,
one size fits all, clearly.
No, and you're still, well, there, you were thinking of the volume of data rather than, because what you said about the Czech Republic data protection authorities, that they're considering the number of people processing it, the employees, in which I have to say, you know, something that I've not really considered much before, you know, the scale of the processing, a contact center of, you know, 2,000 employees is large scale, isn't it? Even if it's only handling 10,000 customers. Or like a utilities business.
It's a really interesting perspective, that, because obviously you look at processing by an organization at organization level, and you know, all staff are part of that rather than an individual level within your organization and the risks that are posed through the more people that access that data. I think that could probably be applied to a lot of other types situations.
So lots of factors, which is really great. I love it when there's lots of factors to consider.
Something that I found quite interesting actually was the Polish data protection authority, when they said that systems in which a processor processes data from multiple data controllers, I don't think that's anything I've really considered either. When I was just thinking then, who could that be? I was thinking maybe like, you know, all these one-man bands you've got who do, you know, work on various housing associations around the country, but I guess they're probably not going to have systems in which they process personal data, but they might do, you know, they might have these small organizations who have a database, and they're probably not even considered. I know we're not in Poland, but you know, you can draw from this guidance, can't you? Because it's useful stuff, and you know, we know we're not in the EU, but it's still prominent, isn't it, in what we do. So maybe these guys aren't even realizing that they're large scale processing.
Interesting. Yeah, I think it's fascinating. I think it's good that the team have got down there and kicked it about and debated it, because again, this is what helps you kind of formulate your own stance on things.
Yeah, definitely. I don't know if anyone has seen any more, especially you, Phil, because I feel like you've mentioned this a few times, but around 23 in May, the other day I saw an advert on Instagram from Join the Claim about seeing whether you're eligible for compensation based on, you know, the breach that they had. And then funnily enough, I saw a case this morning, about 10 minutes before the podcast, about 23andMe saying that it's lost 98% of its 6 billion market value and witnessed the departure of all its independent board members along with nearly half of its workforce. In light of the company's precarious situation, many of its 15 million customers are attempting to have their DNA data deleted from the company's data banks. As the uncertainty surrounding 23andMe deepens, another critical question arises about the fate of users' genetic data. I think we spoke about this maybe a while ago, but also, you know, in relation to that, the fact that there are family members of people who have, you know, used the services that will be affected by this as well. And that's something that they need to consider in relation to how they handle this data. But it did just get me thinking again about when a company Is it dissolves? I feel like it's wrong, Ash Joe, but I don't.
No, no, that's right. Yeah, come to get dissolved.
She don't trust me, does she? Clearly,
I'm overthinking it. what will happen with the data that they have? You know, it's obviously there's so much information there that could be used for research and, you know, for beneficial reasons. But is it just lost? Is it deleted?
Well, we read it was.
Did we not say they're going to sell it as an asset?
Yeah. The administrators are potentially going to sell it as an asset. Yeah.
Would you not see that as further processing, though, obviously, depending on what the privacy notice states?
Yeah, but they're not governed. Potentially not governed by the GDPR in many of their cases. It might be for where they've provided services to European or British residents, but, you know, the rest of the database is probably regulated by different law.
Yeah. But in those cases, is it a matter of, well, there's nothing you can do anyway, so
you can do what you can do, can't you? But again, if there's no employees there to actually manage your Eurasia request because they've all gone and the company's in, you know, being dissolved and the database has been sold and you're going to try and get all of the new owners of the database, I think it's an uphill struggle, isn't it?
Yeah.
But I mean, we would have thought that anybody buying it would have hoped would be quite sensitive to, right, okay, you want your data to out the database, then fine, you know.
Yeah.
Have to contact. Well, no, actually, don't matter, because they're not regulated by the GDPR, are they? So they wouldn't be bound by Article 14, would they, to issue privacy information to those people?
Well, they'd probably be,
unless they're caught by it. But
it's all going to be in the public domain, isn't it? So, you know, they probably end up mounting something on their website, and so there'll probably be ways around it. But they'll be caught by GDPR for where they've offered goods and services, you know, in the EU and in the UK. Or monitored behaviour in the EU or the UK, but, you know, for anybody that's not protected by the GDPR, they're not going to have the same rights.
Yeah. What about, so a customer of mine, they the organisation was set up as a project, really, and I think commissioned by the council or something. They provide support to young families with children under three, I think, and the project is ending at the end of February, so, you know, they're preparing for that. What should they do in that situation? You know, the staff are still going to be there. They still have this data. They might want to pass it on to another organisation who provides similar support. Would you recommend that they go out to their data, you know, the data subjects that they have that they hold data about, and ask if it's okay to pass the information on? Or
anyway, I think it depends on the circumstances. But again, I don't know if you saw this week the ICO issued some guidance on sharing data. So they're saying data protection is not an excuse to not share data. For instance, tackling fraud. And one of the examples they give in their guidance is where a third-party organization asks a telecommunication and digital platform asks you to share data with them on the basis of legitimate interests. And this guidance stepped through the three-step process and concludes that in the circumstances it would be right to share the data, you know, in this artificial scenario.
So
I think you'd have to have a look at the specific circumstances of that, what's happening. You know, a project with great social objectives is passing over to a different provider, you know, what I think is what you're saying, can the data go with it? Well, I would have thought it would be able to go with it. You might have to do some tweaks around the edges of the, you know, compliance bit, but, you know, in essence, the law, I don't think the GDPR was implemented to try and stop that happening. Why would it try and stop that happening? That seems a very legitimate, you know, use of data, ongoing provision of a public service. You know, one provider has finished, one provider's coming in. Surely you'd have to start again. Surely GDPR is not designed to enforce that situation. It can't be. It's just not right. Don't feel right. If you don't feel right, it's probably not right.
Yeah. But there are certain ways that you've got to go about it to do it appropriately.
Yeah, you might have to jump through a few hoops of fire, as you do with these things, you know. But in essence, you know, I would be looking for a way to enable that. No. In essence, I'd be looking at ways, right, you know, this seems right, you know, let's check it and test it, and then let's make sure we dot the I's and cross the T's. Surely the starting point isn't, oh, no, can't do that because of GDPR. computer says no.
But that's what people do.
Bonkers.
But that's what people are. They're under the misconception, aren't they, that they can't share data because of the GDPR restriction from doing it. I had a call with one of our customers reached out to us. I mentioned it on the podcast here, actually. They put on their own events, but they use third parties to do like the ticketing systems and host the event for them. And they wanted the data back of the people who were attending the shows because it's their show and they, you know, they want to do their own business operations like direct marketing. And that organizer was saying that we can't do that because of the GDPR. I'm like, this is not true, is it? It's just, it doesn't restrict you, it enables you. It just means you've got to put things in place in order to do it lawfully.
Yeah, there's a link to the ICO's guidance, which is, you know.
Best to stop me before I go on my soapbox.
Yeah. Now, there's a link to the ICO's guidance. Now then, didn't
all
you
had a similar soapbox after over the episode? Yeah. So I don't think I think everyone knows what to expect there.
Yeah, I was interested in there was a new code of conduct issued this week, I think, or last week, and it's for private investigators. So I've downloaded a copy of it because I'm really quite interested to read it to see what it actually says about, you know, how it's applying. You know, it's official Article 4 Code of Conduct, so I'd be really interested to see how it's structured, what it says, you know, because we tried to we put a lot of effort with some of our clients into writing the code of conduct for the housing industry, but when we went to talk to the ICO about it, you know, we had about three or four meetings with the ICO's team, and at every meeting they were throwing up all sorts of fences and different fences. It was just such hard work, we canned it in the end. But anyway, the private investigator industry seems to have persevered. So they have got an approved code of conduct, the Association of British Investigators. So it's quite long, like 99 pages long, but it'll be interesting reading to see what it actually does. It might cover some of the topics that we've been talking about.
Now, we've not got long left, but I've got a news story, actually, that I found rather quite amusing, actually. Now, do you remember the DPDI bill, how it was going to give powers to DWP to monitor bank accounts for the purpose of fraud detection? And in the summer, there was questions around the bias of the AI system that they're using. And they said, does not, and I quote, the AI system does not present any immediate concerns of discrimination, unfair treatment or detrimental impact on customers. Now, I saw a news story this morning that it said that an artificial intelligence system used by UK government to detect welfare fraud in showing bias, according to people's age, disability, marital status and nationality, the Guardian can reveal. So an internal assessment of machine learning program used to vet thousands of claims for universal credit payments across England found it incorrectly selected people from groups more than others when recommending whom to investigate for possible fraud. The emergence of the bias comes after the DWP this summer claimed, and then, you know, it goes on to say the quote that I just said. I just found it rather quite amusing that they were saying in summer that no, there's
No evidence of bias.
And what's that? Not even a year, 6 months, and there's an investigation out that says that, you know, there is bias, and it's just like, it's just frustrating, isn't it? Because, you know, if the Tories stayed in, you know, the DPDI bill probably would have gone through, and the DWP would have been given these powers using a system that, you know, has clear bias, and it's just like, yeah, it's just infuriating. I don't know. I don't really know what else to say on that, but it's just like, it's just, yeah, annoying.
It's not surprising, though, is it?
It's not, no, not at all.
Yeah.
Now, there's two interesting court cases going through this month later on, one in Ireland and one in Germany, which are both testing compensation for non-material damage for loss of control over personal data. So I'll be really interested to see how they land. The Irish one is due to go through the court, sitting in the Supreme Court on the 17th of December. And the German one, I can't think when that's going through, but not that they'll affect us. But again, it'd be quite interesting to look at it and read it and think about it.
I think we spoke about them last week, was it, in relation to a breach of like 450 people, and some of them weren't initially allowed to put a claim in.
I don't know.
A lot of information goes in and out.
533 million in the case of the German, people in the case of the German thing. It's a Facebook thing. And the Irish one, I'm not sure, Dylan v. Irish Life 2024. So it seems just one person. So it might be something else you're referring to.
Well, I'll be interested to see how they progress, even though it's the first time I've heard of them.
I know. So you said you wanted to talk about something called Know Our Homes, but we've run out of time.
Oh, of course, yeah, I forgot about that. Yeah, I spoke about it earlier.
January to talk about it. No, you run out of time. I'll come back in January to talk about it.
Yeah,
I should put my tissues away.
Jasmine can't. Yeah. Oh no, she'll have to. Oh, she'll have to. Yeah, yeah. Dial in on the fourth, Jasmine.
Yeah, so 200 that I missed out.
You lay your travel plans.
Anyway. Oh, that wasn't mocking, Joe. Don't forget yourself at me. Yeah. So thank you everyone for joining. I don't know who will be back next week, but we'll be back next week for a session.
It's Phil on his own.
Yeah, Phil and.
You're gonna have to try and find some troops, yeah, because Jasmine's away and I'm away as well, so.
Yeah. Be on my way to Scotland.
Oh, I'm Scotland. I can one up you there. I'm going to New York.
Ooh. Anyway, thank you for joining everyone, and hope to see you next week through the podcast. Have a great weekend in the meantime. I'm saying that as like.
We as in DDP.
Yeah. Anyway, bye.
Fucking guys, bye.
Thank you. See you later.